What's the one thing that says country living as loudly as that? It's got to be a barn. Ideally a red barn, but any barn will do. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're taking a look at this nostalgic architectural icon. What's the barn's connection with memory and identity in America? And as barns that have stood on farms for generations begin to crumble and decay, do we rebuild and restore, or do we make way for change? We'll be hearing about efforts to save old barns in Kansas and Missouri right after this news. Rehabbing old barns involves a lot of dirty work. Just ask Jack and Diane Aaron.
It looked pretty bad. The front was coons get up in the rafter there and urinated down the wall and rusted all the nails. Wind blows hard out here. It blew the front, probably 10 or 12 boards out of the front of it. They were just hanging there.
And then others had slipped down. Part
of the wall on this side was pulled out about 4 inches, so we had to pull it back in.
Jack and Diane Aaron moved from Kansas City, Kansas to Raymore, Missouri. They wanted to take a chance, not only on country living, but also on an old barn. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we'll be hearing about old barns hanging in the balance. Most of the classic old barns with that classic old barn architecture were built a long, long time ago. And they are falling into serious disrepair. But lots of people are taking up the cause of restoring them. On today's show, we'll ask what these barns mean to us and whether we should care about preserving them. Do you care what happens to old barns in Kansas and Missouri? If these familiar structures disappeared from our landscape, would it matter? And if so, why? We'll be taking your calls later in today's show. But first, joining us by phone is Jeff Marshall. He's with the National Barn Alliance. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How about you?
I'm very good, thank you.
What is the National Barn Alliance?
It is a group of volunteers from across the country who are dedicated to the preservation of barns and rural way of life and rural agriculture and rural architecture.
Why is the barn demanding to be preserved? What's going on right now?
Well, we've reached a change in much of the country where barns are no longer viable in their original use, and that any historic building, any building that doesn't have a functional use, it's very difficult to keep them, justify expenses to keep them, from falling down.
So let me just clarify, though, these old barns are no longer useful to farmers?
In some cases. Sometimes equipment is too big to get in the barn itself. Sometimes in my part of the country, many of the farms have been subdivided into residential subdivisions, and you don't need a 60 by 80 foot barn if you only have a 5 acre mini estate. So they are caught between the difficulties of modern agriculture and modern suburbia. And we are recognizing that these icons of the agrarian way of life are in fact threatened.
From a national perspective, where is the rehabbing of old barns happening most aggressively right now? Like in what region is this trend really taking off?
I think if you divide that into adaptive reuse, which is the term for a new use for an old building, the northeast part of the country and New England, because you have to find an alternative use, that's where that's strong. If you're talking about the use of them and revitalization as agriculture changes, that's much more active in the central part of the country, where they still fit more so into the agriculture in the 21st century.
You kind of touched on this just now, but is everyone doing this for the same reason and with the same philosophy, or are there kind of different schools within the barn restoration movement?
Well, there are different schools. There is a broad difference between those who think barns should be preserved and used for agricultural purposes only, and those in, again, my part of the country where agriculture isn't viable. They are historic monuments that should be preserved, and it is better to adaptively reuse a building than to have it fall down or be demolished because people don't have a use for it. I think the art in that is when you go to do a rehabilitation for another use, it's while many of these things save the skeleton of an old barn, they lose the soul, and you don't really have that feeling and association, whereas, you know, a good adaptive reuse maintains that character and really still evokes its past.
Are there some particular techniques that help people really preserve the integrity of these old buildings while also adapting them so they're both useful and structurally sound?
Yes. In broad terms, one of the key elements in any barn reuse is making it weathertight, first and foremost. Secondly, heating and air conditioning. How do you take these vast spaces and semi-permeable exteriors and make them weathertight without destroying the character? Those are two of the biggest things. And the other thing that is often overlooked is the window-to-door ratio. A lot of these buildings didn't have windows, and when you do a reuse, most often people want to let light in and ventilation and such, and sometimes they can overdo that and really mask the original shape of the barn.
Interesting. I had never really thought about the absence of much window in most barns.
Well, most of them didn't need them. Some chicken barns and others did, but part of the defining character of the barn is this huge, you know, typically red wood siding, or in my part of the country, big stone barns with uninterrupted, you know, wall surfaces. And that's something that you have to use a good architect to, or a good planning to not completely destroy.
It seems like timing would be a significant piece of any barn rehabbing project, because there might come a point when it's really too late.
Yes, that is critical. And often people try to get other barns to use to restore theirs. And when those are available, it's hard to time as well. But there is a sweet spot or a delta point between when it's too late and when people don't realize that they should do something. It's knowing that you should start to do something now is very as much important as the latter. You know, in the old days when a farmer was in the barn every day, the leak in the roof is noticed and gets taken care of. If you have a barn, you're only in it once a week, once a month, or even more rarely, those little problems grow, and then it becomes too late very quickly.
Let's just say that the sad thing has happened where it is too late and someone wanted to preserve their barn, but it's just too far gone to salvage in its current form. Are there options for them? Is there something that you would recommend?
Yes. First and foremost, we always recommend that you document it. Take pictures of it, measure it, do whatever you can, because I don't know how many times I've dealt with property owners who have a foundation or buy a property and they say, gee, I wonder what was here before. And so just having that record is one thing. And then passing it on to a local historical organization or a barn preservation group is one. The other is try to reuse the barn in the sense of give it a new life by giving it away or having somebody take it away and reassemble it. And then the last is take the specific elements, which maybe you can't use the entire barn, but you can reuse for another use and repurpose them so that at least the energy, time, and effort that went into their construction, if it's a big beam or whatever it is, isn't lost.
This might sound like a flip question, but why do projects like this matter? Why are people so dedicated to this cause right now?
And that's a very good question. I think it's because even though more and more people don't own barns and more people may never have actually been in a barn, people drive down a country road or any road and they seem to have some sort of fascination for folks. And I think it is, as I said at the outset, they're comforting. They represent our idea of the hardworking, self-sufficient life, honest way of life of our forefathers. And this is the last tangible link to that agrarian past.
Well, as you drive along country routes, at least here in the Midwest, you sometimes see these barns, and many of them are looking great, but some are just clearly completely abandoned. Is that something you see nationally, flat-out abandonment, these just really falling into serious decay?
We do, and a lot of it has to do, as I said earlier, that they don't have a function either on the current property because it's farming and they don't need it, or that the farm itself is no longer viable, which is a whole other level of concern. And this is just that physical manifestation of that agricultural and farming isn't viable.
So it's fairly intuitive, but it sounds like you're saying that the fate of the barn as a structure is really tied up with the fate of the small family farm.
Agreed. And that's why I said earlier that the Barn Alliance is also concerned about. The best way to save a building is to make sure it has a use. The best way to save agricultural building is to keep the property in agriculture. So, yes, your point is well taken.
Are there different laws from state to state that kind of shape these barn restoration projects?
Yes, there are different laws and different programs. Most parts of the country, there's the very fundamental sanctity of private property rights. So any effort to limit a property owner's ability to do what they want with their property has to be done very carefully. And, you know, I am a preservationist, but I also believe in, you know, American civil rights. So I always think that we have to educate people rather than legislate. But having said that, there are some programs in different states and even different municipalities that have historic zoning that says you can't do certain things to buildings without approvals. That what we prefer are different incentive programs that incentivize the restoration of historic structures, including barns, by tax credits or some other type of program.
What do you make of the current trend of barns as event venues, like really popular event venues for wedding receptions and things like that? These are mostly young people who didn't necessarily grow up on farms themselves.
Right. I think it's a very big issue in where I am, which is Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And part of the positive is it gets people into barns. And I've always thought that people only preserve what they love, and they only love what they experience. So getting people in a barn is a wonderful experience. The flip side is, as I deal with a lot of municipal officials, is fire safety, public safety is critically important. And when you use these venues on a very limited ad hoc basis, very often they don't have the requisite escape areas or fireproofing. And that's what concerns a lot of the municipal officials, is that potential for disaster.
Barns and fires, that's kind of interesting. I mean, you just brought back to me that childhood song of Mrs. O'Leary left a lantern in the shed and the cow kicked it over.
And that's a real problem. And there, you know, and again, if there was to be a problem, people getting hurt, and, you know, I don't think anybody wants that. I don't think that is worth preservation of any building, unfortunately, as much as I am a preservationist.
Well, Jeff, pretty soon we're going to let you get back to your busy day, but I just have one more question for you. Are there certain types of barns unique to Kansas and Missouri that we should be paying a lot of attention to?
There's what's generally called a Midwestern barn, which is different than the Pennsylvania barn, but I think it has barns in your area are often much bigger, almost always of wood frame construction, and, you know, are designed, as you expect, to put a place for the processing and storage of the materials from the farms in the Midwest. So they're usually often the biggest barns we see are in your region.
Biggest ones. That's awesome. Thank you so much for talking with us this morning, Jeff Marshall.
It is my pleasure.
Jeff was with us by phone from the National Barn Alliance. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to turn to our in-studio guests now, but we'd also like to hear from you. Do you care what happens to old barns in Kansas and Missouri? If these familiar structures were to someday disappear from our landscape, would it matter to you? Call us and tell us why. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And for inspiration, check out the slideshow of barn photographs submitted by our KCUR listeners. You can see those photos at kcur.org. Now it's time to say hello to Daryl Zimmerman. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, Gina.
You've had kind of a long drive to see us today. Where did you drive from?
DeSoto, Kansas. We're still in Johnson County. We're not that far away.
Not too far. Well, it seems far sometimes. Tell us about your barn. Tell us your story.
I grew up on a farm. I'm 78 years of age and lived in the town of DeSoto my entire life. And growing up on a farm, I like to tell the story that in the 1950s, my parents bought what is now known as Kill Creek Farm. And other farm families would come to visit, and the women would talk about the latest Jell-O dessert containing Dream Whip, and the men would discuss the weather and the price of corn, and the kids would go out and explore the barns. So I've loved barns from a very early beginning. And in I left public education in 1993.
You were a teacher.
For 34 years, most of that career in the same school building that I had lessons in and graduated from. So I like to tell people I never got very far in life. I started raising pumpkins and having a harvest festival and giving children's tours of our farm. So I really never left teaching because I like to share what little bit I knew about farming during that period of time. And I decided that we needed a more permanent structure.
What was impermanent about the structure that was there?
Well, it was a tent, and it blew down several times during, I don't think we had a, for the like 6 years that we sold our pumpkins out of a tent, that there wasn't a season went by that it didn't blow down at least once. They were rented, fortunately, so I didn't have to pay for putting them back up. But it was kind of distracting. So I was looking for a more permanent structure, and I recall that when my children were in 4-H activities, we visited a family called the Waitsman family, and there was an old timber frame barn there. So I went to see the family, and the lady of the house answered the door, and I said, "Have you ever thought about getting rid of that old barn?" And she laughed, and she said, "My husband's been trying to give it away for the past 3 years. One man came and said he'd take it, and he came back later and said his wife wouldn't let him have it." So I said, "That's not a problem with me. I need the barn, and I think it would be a perfect addition to a farm." It became the White Waitsman Barn, giving recognition to the White family that probably built it originally in the 1880s, and the Waitsman family that gave it to me. We had it disassembled. We brought it to my farm, and volunteer neighbors and I put it together in about 4.5 months. We saved primarily just the heavy timber frame that was joined with mortise and tenon joints held together with oak pegs.
Well, you're telling a story kind of a barn that prior to your arrival, they literally could not give away.
That's right.
Why not?
People looked at it and thought, "Oh my goodness, I could put up a new steel barn, a pole barn, for much less money, and I wouldn't have to paint it." There were all those reasons.
Is that the trend now, a steel barn?
Oh yes, farming sites become almost you can't tell them from a factory development in a commercial part of a city.
What did you like about this barn in particular, that you were willing to go to all the trouble to disassemble it, reassemble it, transport all the pieces?
I think it was the history and the craftsmanship that was in this barn. To think that the family that built that barn did it all without any power tools. They had to plan it out. They constructed it in a manner. Actually, it was built prior to even the thresh machines coming in to harvest, separate the wheat from the straw. And it was called a transverse crib barn with a threshing floor in down the center of it.
What is a threshing floor?
It was a wooden covered floor that the farmers would shock the wheat, bring it into the barn, and actually beat the grain out with a stick was attached to another stick that was hinged, and they would flail it, and that was the name of the piece of equipment. A lot of labor, and then they would, because this barn was a transverse crib barn, it had doors on both ends, so the wind could blow through it, and it would take that wheat and chaff and put it into a tray and flip it up into the air, and the wind would blow the chaff away. So they were separating the grain from the chaff.
Well, speaking of wind, I mean, in the Midwest, a lot of the danger to a structure like this, I would think, would be tornadoes.
Yes, and I have a very personal experience from that. Our barn was put up in the year 2000 at Kill Creek Farm, and on May the 12th of 2010, a microburst, or tornado, in my opinion, came through and literally destroyed it. It scattered pieces clear across Kill Creek Road, which is what our farm is named after. And so I was at a loss as what to do. But hundreds of people came, not just to gawk and look like they do when there's disasters, but they helped clean up the materials and salvage what we could. And it wasn't a question of, are you going to rebuild the barn, but when are you going to rebuild the barn?
So you mentioned hundreds of people who wanted to participate in this. So that means that there's something about this structure that matters not only to you, but to a lot of people. What do you think explains that?
I shared the barn with people. I shared the barn with all those people that helped restore it. I had some people say, well, how did you entice all of these people to come? You didn't even pay them. You gave them a T-shirt if they worked a half a day, and you sometimes bought their lunch. But we had more fun than as we joked, a bunch of old guys should have and have it legal. We just simply had a ball at it. And so the barn then became a place to sell pumpkins out of and store straw. But very quickly it became brides want to know if they could rent it for their wedding and wedding receptions. And the Chamber of Commerce met there, and the Rotary Club that I'm a member of, they used the barn for barn dances and just all sorts of activities. And it was my new classroom when school students came to learn about farm life.
Did the conversation with Jeff Marshall of the National Barn Alliance resonate with you? I noticed you sort of pumping your fists in the air triumphantly when he talked about getting people in barns at these wedding receptions.
I never met Jeff personally, but I have read of his words and watched him on YouTube and on the internet. But to sum it up, when he said, we save what we love, and we appreciate more those things when we have a better understanding of their history, their background.
So. Could there also be something to kind of the idea that we don't know what we've got until we fear we might lose it? Maybe people took these structures for granted as a part of their landscape, but as the song goes, we don't love our water till our well runs dry.
That's very true. And once these barns are gone, there's just practical no way of restoring them. You probably know from the pictures that I sent in that we are rebuilding the barn. It's no longer my barn. It is the barn at Kill Creek Farm Association, a not-for-profit. I leased the land to that association for a 99-year lease, and that's my legacy to the community. But it will never be the same barn because it doesn't have that post where the horses cribbed on when they got bored standing in their stalls, or it doesn't have another beam that has a place where the rat chews to see if there was better grain to eat on the other side of that wall. So it's missing that character. Jeff mentioned that there has to be changes because the barn, when I put it up originally, it was to give me a place that was truly a barn, a farm use, a barn to store straw in. Now I can't store straw in the new barn. It's a fire hazard. I had to, because it's a public use building now, it has to have handicapped entrances and exits. It has to have indoor plumbing. We had an old Works Progress Administration, WPA as it's called, outhouse that was our restroom facilities, and we had a freezeless hydrant out front. Now we have running water. And
so authenticity only goes so far.
It does, because it's very difficult to comply with the new building codes, which I understand the necessity, but it really makes it difficult when you're trying to recreate a barn for public use.
And barn quilts are a part of this whole effort, too. What is a barn quilt?
A barn quilt is anywhere from a 4 by 4 foot square to usually an 8 by 8 foot square of a barn quilt pattern painted, and then on this background material, usually plywood, and placed on the side of a barn to where it can be viewed by from the public right away. So people can actually make tours. I think it's a beautiful thing because it combines the architecture of barns with the beauty of quilts. So there's a real melding together of two two things that can reinforce each other. People can get their fill of seeing all these neat barn quilts, patterns, and also see these barns that they normally would not see when they were driving down the interstate.
What's going on with barn quilt preservation?
The program started less than 15 years ago, and now there are barn quilt trails in nearly every state in the United States. The first one in Kansas was started in Franklin County by their visitors and bureau, and they gave a presentation at our Kansas Barn Alliance meeting 3 years ago. They had 25 barn quilts on their trail, and now they have 36. So it's growing, and I want to start one in Johnson County, and I've already picked out the design for my barn.
Ooh, okay. Well, we'll hear more about this when we get back. Central Standard's going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be taking your calls about why and whether barns matter. 816-235-2888. Central Standard will be right back. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're talking about barns. Specifically, what can be done to preserve or restore them once they've begun falling into decay? We're taking your calls at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also see photographs of barns in Kansas and Missouri submitted by KCUR listeners at kcur.org. Now we've got writer and photographer Mark Luce on the line. He's also a teacher at the Barstow School, and he took on a really interesting artistic exploration of old barns a few years back. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Gina. How are you doing this morning?
Great. How about you?
I'm doing all right.
Explain your project.
Well, several years ago, I guess 2009 or so, I was at home outside of Salina on land that was my grandfather's, and I was at a family gathering, and as sometimes family gatherings go, I really needed to get away, and so...
A little fresh air.
Just need a little breather. And hopped in a car and drove around. So this is outside of Salina, a little bit north of Culver, so to the north and west of Salina, and drove around basically the neighborhood where I spend my summers around my grandparents' farm, and I was shocked at how much things had changed. Houses that had been lived in were now abandoned. Structures that had been standing were now either destroyed or crumbling. And so it struck me in a certain way. And so I came up with this idea to basically travel the state looking for things that had broken, that had fallen apart. And while that's where I started, what I found was that I became far more intrigued, not so much by the decay, but by the fact that some of these buildings, despite to normal folks seeing that they are falling apart, they're holding on. The buildings are resilient, much like the people are resilient. And so that project took me maybe a couple years and had short fiction that went with it. And then as I continued in this vein, I got rid of the fiction and basically pushed the camera in closer to look at sort of the map of close-ups, basically that when you push your camera forward to a back alley building or the side of a building in a small town, what you see actually is kind of a topographical map of that area. So that's really where I was coming from with this project.
Something people say about photography is that the camera helps you to see better and to look more closely. Is there anything the camera helped you to see in these structures that you might not have noticed otherwise?
I think a couple different things. One, color. We tend to think of old stuff as sort of either gray or white or maybe a faded red. But especially when I pushed in very close, we're talking 6-8 inches close, you saw I mean, I really saw landscapes, and I started to relate those landscapes to the landscapes that I saw around me. So in that way, I think it helped me, honestly, it helped me slow down, and it helped me look at things. I don't want to go so far as to say microscopically, because I don't have that kind of equipment. But
it's not a microscope.
No, but it's a lesser version of a microscope, and I think that for me, making the connection between the buildings or the structures and the sort of ethos of a place was really quite a find for me, because originally, you know, I went with a very kind of chilly, non-sentimental, people are leaving, right? This is a fact. I mean, and what I found was that wasn't interesting to me. What was interesting is the relationship between the built environment, the land, and the people.
What did other people see in your work when it was done? Did their responses to these photographs surprise you in any way?
I don't know. I mean, people were very kind. The people said kind things. I don't know. I don't know exactly. The first group had fiction with them, and so I think the people responded far more to the fiction than the photograph. I mean, the fiction informs the photograph, then it kind of limits what their interpretation. When I pushed forward, I was much happier with the work. And I think everybody wanted to know what it was. Like, that was sort of the thing. Like, what is that? What is that? And you're like, well, that's the side of a building in, you know, with St. John, Kansas, you know, or it's an old bulldozer that's rusted and, you know, on some abandoned land.
What does the Kansas barn, either as an actual thing or even just as an idea, mean to you?
Well, as a photographer, to me, the barn, like the picture of the barn with the setting sun, right, like that's not, or the windmill, it's like, that's not what I want. When I think of barns, I think about my grandfather ran two different, he ran a quarter section, and then he had a half section south of the house, and we had a big barn in there, and it was, you know, it smelled like hay and dust, and when we were teenagers, we found some adult magazines hidden up in the loft from the previous owner.
So barn lofts have multiple uses.
Yeah. And to me, it just represents a working farm. Like, that's how I think. I think of them as very practical and not so much, icons. It's like it's something that you use. It's not necessarily something that you photograph just to look at. I think of that story. Do you know this Alice Walker story, Everyday Use?
No.
Story. Well, so basically, a woman comes back home. She doesn't want to be. She doesn't care much for home, other than she wants to get items and like put them on the wall. And so she has this quilt, and she tells her mother, it's like, my sister is dumb enough to use that quilt every day. And, you know, the irony is that's what you're supposed to do. And so for me, the barn is something that you use every day.
And that's the way you love something.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's like, yeah, you don't, if I have a quilt, I don't need to put it on a wall. What I need to do is use it to keep warm at night.
Right.
Well, and I don't need to show it off. And so, to me, there's a practical. People don't build barns strictly for aesthetics. They build barns because they need to build barns. And now, you know, of course, they don't. They put up Morton buildings instead. And the Morton building, I guess, has a certain retro charm, but it's just not the same.
Well, thanks, Mark Luce. It's been so fun talking with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Mark is a teacher, writer, and photographer who works at Barstow School, and he regularly joins Up to Date as one of their book doctors. And we're going to get back to our in-studio guest, Daryl Zimmerman, who comes to us from DeSoto, Kansas, shortly. But we've got lots of callers on the line, so I want to go ahead and bring them in on this conversation. Let's talk to Megan in St. Joseph. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
What can you share with us?
I have a beautiful barn that's about 150 years old, about 2 miles north of St. Joseph. It's about 14,000 square feet, and the beams are hand-hewn, and there's about seven different kinds of wood in it, and the property that it sits on was my family's working farm, and now it's not a working farm, and the property is for sale. And for the last couple years, I've been trying to educate myself and find the right way to repurpose the barn, because I know that when someone buys the property, they're probably going to bulldoze the barn, and I don't want to let that happen. So I called in to see if there was some sort of connection to a group that might I might be able to help educate myself on ways to find a good home for the barn.
What bothered you about the idea of that barn someday being bulldozed, perhaps?
Aesthetically, it's beautiful, and I remember it from my first memory of it was when I was about 5 or 6 years old, and I'm also a photographer, like the person before me speaking, and it was the first place that I saw light move, and I was sitting on a big stack of hay bales, and it was the most amazing thing to me, and it's also a place where I've been able to look out the window and see the beautiful Missouri landscape.
And so you were able to get this on the historic register, is that right?
Yes, my father did.
How did that process work?
It took him about 10 years of writing letters, but a Civil War general lived in the house and owned the property, and so it sort of has an interesting history. And my father was a preservationist and appreciated architecture and land, and he just wanted to see that happen.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Megan. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you.
And Daryl Zimmerman, you've been here in this conversation for a while. What do you hear in Megan's story that might really resonate with a lot of people you've met who are pursuing these kinds of projects?
Well, her and her father have taken fantastic steps to on the way of preservation. But for anyone wanting to find ways to preserve barns, if you're a Kansan, the first thing to do is become a member of the Kansas Barn Alliance, and it has the same mission as the National Barn Alliance. For example, the membership is about $30 per year, and one of the highlights of the event is the 2014 Barn Alliance Barn Fest.
Well, that sounds like an interesting organization. And one of the things Mark Luce was talking about was the details of the old barns. And over the break, we were talking about the sweat that had gotten on one of the beams in your barn. So help us really zero in through words, maybe not through a lens, on this detail of the barn that you are restoring.
Well, this was the first barn that I restored. And as I mentioned earlier, it is gone. The only salvaged parts was the cupola on top and the four little windows. Barns were quite dark because they didn't need the light. They wanted to store the loose hay up in the hayloft to feed the animals during the winter months. And where the ladder went up to climb up into the loft, the beam was very rounded, almost as though someone had taken a planer and just rounded it really smooth. And I finally became aware that during the summer, when the farmers were sweating up there in July, mowing away that loose hay, as they would climb down to get a drink of water or refresh themselves, their arm would wipe over this beam and wipe the sweat onto it. And mice and rats like human beings, need a certain amount of salt in their diet. So they had actually gnawed that beam smooth and rounded to get that salt.
Little architects and engineers.
That's right. That's
well,
right.
We have put out the call for our listeners to join this conversation, and we've got a few of them I want to turn to. We're going to go to Daisha, who called 816-235-2888 to be part of this Central Standard conversation on KCUR 89.3 FM. Let's turn to Daisha and Lawrence. Hi, Daisha.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Great. Yeah, thank you.
First, I wanted to say I think it's great that there is somebody out there preserving barns. I had no idea anyone was doing that. So, but I wanted to share a story. Last July, for my grandpa's 93rd birthday, met my cousin halfway for dinner in Junction City, and driving him on the way back, he was pointing out where his family's land used to be, just outside of Wamego. And I said, well, let's take a detour. And so he told me right where to go. It was just outside of Alma, Kansas. And we pulled up in front of the house of his farm. And I said, would you be embarrassed if I went up and asked if we could take some pictures in front of it? And he said, oh, I suppose not. So we went up and nobody was home, but we took pictures. I took pictures of my grandpa with his great-grandkids, my boys. And we walked the farm, and he pointed out there were two barns that were there when he lived there. And they had gotten a more modern, you know, steel barn, and one of them had been added onto, and the other one looked really old, but he said it was pretty much, you know, wood and stone, how it was when he was there. And he went through and was just showing me what was there, what wasn't there, and he telling me about what wasn't there, telling me family stories. Oh, we used to fish in the creek over here. I used to go in this field and hunt for rabbits. And it was just absolutely, I can't put into words the feeling I got from that.
Yeah,
I hear
you saying that these places hold memories.
Oh, yeah. It's a connection to the past, you know.
Well, how did you feel being told about what used to be there and not being able to see it yourself? Did that affect you and how you feel about this conversation we're having today?
Oh, absolutely. That made me kind of sad. And I was trying to picture in my mind what he was describing. And then I thought, wow, we're really lucky that the house and the barns and the silo and stuff are still there. That was there. You know, this was the house he was born in, the house he grew up in. And, you know, he remembered so much. And, you know, people take some of the best wedding photos in front of old barns. You know, it's something that you can't get from a big steel building. And, you know, I'm not a farmer, you know, I'm sure I can't, you know, begrudge anybody for getting updated things. But, you know, this stuff needs to be preserved. And this was hands down one of the greatest moments of my life.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
That was Daisha and Lawrence, who called to participate in this conversation. Daryl Zimmerman, what do you think about her comments? It's true that some of these things already have not been preserved.
That's true. And that is brought to me every day as I look at the new barn that's replacing the White Waitsman barn that was destroyed by that tornado. I walk into it and say, you know, this is a neat barn. I tried to replicate the old barn as close as possible with timber framing, but it's not the same. I can't touch the same beam that I touched before. My hand can't slide down that rail that went to the loft like it did before.
Let's hear from Joyce in Lawrence, Kansas. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. It's so good to listen. I guess it's Daryl. It's not Dale Zimmerman, but Daryl.
Yeah, that's right.
We're in rural Lawrence out north into Jefferson County. We do have a small ranch, although there's 600 acres or so. We do direct market our beef and have a wonderful old barn like he's talking about, that very old wooden floor, open both ends, wooden beams.
And you use it as it was intended to be used?
We use it to store hay. We put small bales of hay in the loft. We can hold up to 2,000 small bales. And I don't know how many we've got up there. Yes, we have an elevator that we put hay in. We raise our own hay. The cattle never leave our place unless they're sold. But not marketing our beef. It's just that this barn 2 years ago had deteriorated so much. We've got to restore this. We used a bunch of money to restore it. It's beautiful now. It still needs work down on the lower level. We do not have it fixed like we would like to. The horses that we had in the past have been in there. There could be so much else done with it. But the outside has been restored, and we footed the bill on that. But it, when this happens again, I think it will. We had someone, the roof is rusting through, the boards, the sides need replaced. Someone well do, who knew what to do, they did it well. And I think it will last several years. But the big problem is when we're gone, and I'm 73, when we're gone, who will restore it? Who, and I heard him say the first thing you needed to do was join the Kansas Barn Alliance. Well, I'm not even familiar with that and didn't even know there was something that, or a group that might be of assistance with that.
Because, well, Joyce, let's talk about this idea of that maybe some of the people who really care about these things are people who have grown up with these structures as part of their surroundings. And in a generation, two generations, what then?
It's hard to look into the future, but it is my hope and desire that we can educate people now about the procedures and techniques to save these structures from total destruction. The Kansas Barn Alliance is an educational program. There's 15 board members from across the state, and I'm fortunate enough to be one of those members. And this September in Dickinson County, which is where Abilene's located, we're having the 8th annual Barn Fest. It's a weekend event where we have experts come in and talk about preservation, about getting on the National Registry and State Registry of Historic Structures. And we have people on that will open up their barns in that area. We'll probably visit 4 or 5 barns in Dickinson County.
Very cool. Well, let's talk now with Richard in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Richard.
Hi, good morning. I'm so glad you're having this conversation. I don't have a connection with barns. I didn't grow up on a farm. I don't even know anybody particularly that owns an old barn, but I travel a lot in Kansas, especially on the back roads, and I love them because they're beautiful. I do some photography, but mostly landscapes. I like to incorporate them into a landscape because, especially further west, they stand against the sky and against the ground, just this stark, beautiful architecture that a new metal barn can't possibly be photogenic in the way that the old barns are. They have architecture, they have texture, they have shape, they have color. But in general, they stand mostly just by default. And in my experience, a lot of them are on a little square of land that the farmer doesn't plow, and or the rancher, and maybe they store some old equipment in them, but they just kind of stand there because nobody goes to the trouble to push them down in a lot of cases, especially outside of the little town.
So it sounds like you're painting a picture of a very defiant structure.
They are. It's because they were built so strong. I mean, a lot of them. I just saw one the other day that had the roof part of the roof ripped open and laid back on top of itself, but it's still revealing the inside, which was had beautiful color in the inside of the rafters, but they're incredibly strong. And but sadly, a lot of them just kind of eventually melt into the ground because there's no money to keep them. They don't get used, so they just kind of stand by default. But they are beautiful, and I encourage anybody to get off the interstate, drive a couple of back roads, and you'll see a few, and they're nice.
From a photographer's standpoint, what is it? I mean, you've described a lot of the features, but is there one particular feature of these barns that just calls to you?
It's the shape. It's the architecture. It's undeniable that, you know, the space for light between the boards, the shape of them, the patina that comes with. So I'm sorry, that's not one thing, but I look at the shape. And the fact that they, you know, they just have this depth to them, and they fit with the landscape. They're wooden. They're not metal. Metal barns look are functional, but they look alien.
Huh.
And these are with the landscape, and they're part of it. So when you have a field of wheat growing over, around a wooden barn, especially an old weathered one, it's the most natural-looking thing you could think of.
Thanks so much, Richard. That was Richard from Kansas City, Missouri. And speaking of old and weathered and texture, I'm holding two pieces of joinery, Daryl, and you brought them in today. And my left hand is something that feels really grainy, and it has irregularly carved edges that it looks like were not made by a machine. And this other one is a perfectly smooth, like, column. What am I holding in my hands?
The rough one is a hand-hewn draw peg made of oak that was used to hold the tenon into the mortise of a post. And they were actually called draw pegs before the use of strap come-alongs to draw beams together. The barn builders would actually drill the holes in the mortise post at a different time than those in the tenon. So when they put the tenon in, the point of the peg would start in, and as they drove it home, it drew the joint together. Now they use mechanical means to do that, and they drill the hole through everything at one time and drive in a maple, perfectly round maple peg.
So is this, when we hear Richard talking about things like that this old weathered barn kind of structure and ethos is something that's part of the landscape. Is that something that you think can be captured in this roughly hewn piece of joinery I'm holding in my hand?
It can't be replicated.
It can't be replicated, and why not?
The skills, the time and effort that was put into this just isn't part of our modern methods of doing things.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. I'd like to thank all of today's guests for their contributions to this discussion about rehabbing old barns in Kansas and Missouri. And thanks especially to you, Daryl Zimmerman of DeSoto, for joining us in the studio throughout the show. Best of luck with your barn.
Thank you.
To listen back to today's show or any past conversations on Central Standard, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Stay current on our news by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. Tomorrow, we'll continue our exploration of life in the Midwest with a discussion of what it means to be a Midwesterner. The Kansas City Star's Bill Timaeus will be joining us for that conversation, and we hope you will too. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date next.